In the late 60s, comedy was in transition. The older school told jokes and stories, punctuated with the drummer's rim shot. Of the new school, Bill Cosby, one of the first to tell stories you actually believed were true, and Bob Newhart, who startled everyone with innovative low-key delivery and original material, had achieved icon status. A few years earlier, Von Meter, a skilled impressionist whose specialty was the First Family, had been nullified by JFK's assassination. George Carlin and Richard Pryor, though very funny, were still a few years away from their final artistic breakthroughs. Lenny Bruce had died several years earlier, fighting both the system and drugs, and his work was already in revival because of his caustic brilliance that made authority nervous. Vietnam, the first televised war, split the country, and one's left or right bent could be recognized by haircuts and clothes. The country was angry, and so was comedy, which was addressed to insiders. Cheech and Chong spoke to the expanding underground by rolling the world's largest doobie on film. There were exceptions. Don Rickles seemed to glide over the generation gap with killer appearances on The Tonight Show, and Johnny Carson remained a gentle satirist while maintaining a nice glossary of naughty boy breast jokes. Tim Conway and Harvey Korman, two great comic sketch actors working for the affable genius Carol Burnett, were deeply funny. The television free-for-all called Laugh-In kept its sense of joy, thanks in part to Goldie Hawn's unabashed goofiness and producer George Slaughter's perceptive use of her screw-ups. But even that show had high political content. In general, however, a comedian in shackles for indecent language or a singer's arrest for obscene gestures thrilled the growing underground audience. Silliness was just not appropriate for hip culture. It was this circumstance that set the stage for my success 8 years later. In a college psychology class, I had read a treatise on comedy explaining that a laugh was formed when the storyteller created tension, then, with the punchline, released it. I didn't quite get the concept, nor do I still, but it stayed with me and eventually sparked my second wave of insights. With conventional joke-telling, there's a moment when the comedian delivers the punchline and the audience knows it's the punchline, and their response ranges from polite to uproarious. What bothered me about the formula was the nature of the laugh it inspired, a vocal acknowledgement that a joke had been told, like automatic applause at the end of a song. A skillful comedian could coax a laugh with tiny indicators, such as a vocal tick, Bob Hope's, but I want to tell you, or even a slight body shift. Jackie Leonard used to punctuate jokes by slapping his stomach with his hand. One night, watching him on The Tonight Show, I noticed that several of his punchlines had been unintelligible, and the audience had actually laughed at nothing but the cue of his hand slap. These notions stayed with me for months until they formed an idea that revolutionized my comic direction. What if there were no punchlines? What if there were no indicators? What if I created tension and never released it? What if I headed for a climax, but all I delivered was an anticlimax? What would the audience do with all that tension? Theoretically, it would have to come out sometime. But if I kept denying them the formality of a punchline, the audience would eventually pick their own place to laugh, essentially out of desperation. This type of laugh seemed stronger to me, as they would be laughing at something they chose, rather than being told exactly when to laugh. To test my idea, at my next appearance at the Ice House, I went on stage and began, "I'd like to open up with sort of a funny comedy bit. This has really been a big one for me. It's the one that put me where I am today. I'm sure most of you will recognize the title when I mention it. It's the nose on microphone routine. And it's always funny no matter how many times you see it." I leaned in and placed my nose on the mic for a few long seconds. Then I stopped and took several bows, saying, "Thank you very much." "That's it," they thought. Yes, that was it. The laugh came not then, but only after they realized I had already moved on to the next bit. Now that I assigned myself to an act without jokes, I gave myself a rule. Never let them know I was bombing. This is funny, you just haven't gotten it yet. If I wasn't offering punchlines, I'd never be standing there with egg on my face. It was essential that I never show doubt about what I was doing. I would move through my act without pausing for the laughs, as though everything were an aside. Eventually, I thought, the laughs would be playing catch-up to what I was doing. Everything would be delivered in passing, or the opposite, an elaborate presentation that climaxed in pointlessness. Another rule was to make the audience believe that I thought I was fantastic, that my confidence could not be shattered. They had to believe that I didn't care if they laughed at all, and that this act was going on with or without them. I was having trouble ending my show. I thought, why not make a virtue of it? I started closing with extended bowing, as though I heard heavy applause. I kept insisting that I needed to beg off. No, nothing, not even this ovation I am imagining, can make me stay. My goal was to make the audience laugh, but leave them unable to describe what it was that had made them laugh. In other words, like the helpless state of giddiness experienced by close friends tuned into each other's sense of humor, you had to be there. At least, that was the theory. And for the next 8 years, I rolled it up a hill like Sisyphus. My first reviews came in. One said, "This so-called comedian should be told that jokes are supposed to have punchlines." Another said I represented the most serious booking error in the history of Los Angeles music. Wait, I thought. Let me explain my theory. My job with the Smothers Brothers allowed me to move to the hippie center of Southern California, Laurel Canyon. In 1968, Laurel Canyon was considered by the in-crowd to be a nature reserve because of the presence of trees, even though the Democratic Los Angeles smog covered all areas. Joni Mitchell lived there, so did Carole King, so did Kenny Loggins and Frank Zappa. I never met any of them, but I did reconnect with the person who, for the next 15 years, would be the most significant figure in my performing life. His name was Bill McEwen, and he was the older brother of my high school friend John McEwen. John, a musician since the ninth grade, had joined a group, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and Bill, who aspired to be a show business entrepreneur in the mold of Elvis's Colonel Parker, was managing them. It was simply coincidence that Bill and I had both moved, with intermittent stops, from Garden Grove to Laurel Canyon. Bill had a deep love of early blues, country, and bluegrass music. He would pick up his guitar and sing Jimmy Rogers' line, "He's in the jailhouse now," and snap a string, giving the note a slight percussion. He also spotted genius. At Pepe's, a dinky club in St. Louis, he saw an act called the Almond Joys and brought them to Hollywood. They changed their name to Hourglass, and he represented them for a while before they became the Allman Brothers Band. A few years later, he would create and produce a revered country music album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, for which, it seems to me, everyone gets credit but him, even though Bill dreamed it all up and made it happen. He corralled some recording time for me at those Nashville sessions, after Mother Maybelle Carter, Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, and Jimmy Martin had gone home for the evening, to lay down some banjo tunes I'd written. In 1981, the songs appeared on my final last gasp comedy album, The Steve Martin Brothers. Bill McEwen was rebellious, defiant, and loved to watch the big guy squirm. After I had achieved success, he said to me, "Right now there are a lot of old-time comedians saying, 'What the fuck?'" He had banged his way out of nowhere, too, living just a few miles from me in Garden Grove and growing up under the thumb of a critical father. He had long hair before it was fashionable and kept it not only after it was unfashionable, but forever. He also loved comedy. We were united in our worship of Johnny Carson, Don Rickles, Steve Allen, and Jerry Lewis. You can hear Bill's laugh buried somewhere on each of my albums. He even came up with one of my staple jokes of the period. "Do you mind if I smoke?" No. "Do you mind if I fart?" We started hanging around together, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, along with his beautiful wife, Alice, who was an excellent photographer. My MGB GT seated two, which meant one of us had to ride in the hatchback trunk, and it was always Bill who, at 6'4", had to curl up like a cat to fit into the car. Bill, after seeing my act 100 times, asked if he could manage me. "What's a manager?" I said. After he explained, I didn't quite understand, and I don't think he did either, but we struck a handshake deal for no other reason than we had nothing to lose. John McEwen, whom I hadn't seen in about a year, came to the house. He had been on the road and grown his hair long, which surprised me, because I was still resisting. He noted my response, stroked his locks, and said, "Part of the business." Soon after, I grew my hair long, and with my earnings from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, financed a garish collection of turquoise jewelry that I would wear on stage. I was now a full-blown hippie, though not walking around stoned because of my earlier disastrous experience. I riffed on the drug era with this bit, which was delivered in a secretive, low manner. I'm on drugs. You know what I'm talking about. I like to get small. It's very dangerous for kids, because they get really small. I know I shouldn't get small when I'm driving, but I was driving around the other day and a cop pulls me over and says, "Hey, are you small?" I said, no, I'm tall. He says, "Well, I'm going to have to measure you." They give you a little test with a balloon, and if you can get inside it, they know you're small. And they can't put you in a regular cell either, because you'll walk right out. The Smothers Brothers Show continued to rankle the brass at both CBS and the federal halls of power. Sketches dealing with race, war, and politics, mixed in with anomalies such as Kate Smith singing God Bless America, made it a hit in the ratings and at the water cooler. It thrived on controversy, but we writers didn't know the level of rancor the brothers were facing. One morning in 1969, I was driving to work when I heard on the radio that the Smothers Brothers Show had been ignominiously axed. Ostensibly, CBS canceled the show because of a late delivery of an episode, but I knew what really had canceled it, a trickle-down from President Nixon. The brothers had surely made Nixon's enemies list, and probably all of us writers had too, and the political pressure must have been too much for lumbering CBS, which didn't need static from the FCC. After the show's demise, our team of eight writers won Emmys, the Academy's defiant response to the CBS brass. But even after this gold-plated recognition, my father still urged me to go back to college so I would have something to fall back on. Comedy was now fully charged with political energy. George Carlin transformed himself from the hippy-dippy weatherman into a true social commentator. So did the volatile Richard Pryor, who dropped the gags, appealed to the underground audience, and used motherfucker as poetic punctuation. Robert Klein was the educated one. You sat in the audience nodding in agreement with his tart observations. After the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour fell, I joined in with my never-miss Nixon jokes. Nixon's best friend is Bebe Rebozo, a name that means to have bozoed again. All I had to do was mention Nixon's name, and there were laughs from my collegiate audiences. Bob Einstein and I had become a solid workhorse writing team. When the Smothers Brothers ended, we continued to get jobs, including the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, which kept me busy for 7 months out of the year. During the hiatuses, I would slog away at my act. Bill had put me on the road, opening the show for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and I am grateful to them because they really didn't need me. We went everywhere. Atlanta, Spokane, Madison, Little Rock, Tallahassee, you name it, I was there. Colleges, clubs, and concert halls in what seemed like every state in the Union. One magical night, on a lonely road in upstate New York, the bus pulled over and we all got out for a stretch of the legs. We looked north into the moonless black sky. Above us, in this low latitude, shimmered the aurora borealis. Mostly, I was alone on these road trips, and I would while away the solitary daytime hours by indulging my growing interest in American art of the 19th and 20th centuries. I haunted museums and galleries, making quick visual checks in the local antique stores in hopes of finding a Winslow Homer that had gone astray. I never did, but I managed to buy a 19th century picture by the English artist John Everett Millais, thinking that I had made the find of the century, only to discover that it was a tired old fake that had been around the art market for years. This was a cheap lesson in my art collecting hobby, which would develop fully a decade later. I also killed time in college libraries, browsing for books on American art. After spotting a rare and valuable book in the stacks at the University of Tulsa, it was Mabel Dodge Lewin's early treatise on Southwestern painting, Taos and Its Artists. I wondered if I could smuggle it past the low-tech librarian, but my better judgment prevailed, and I left it in place. In Los Angeles, there was an exploding number of new afternoon television talk shows. The Della Reese Show, the Merv Griffin Show, the Virginia Graham Show, the Dinah Shore Show, the Mike Douglas Show, and my favorite, the Steve Allen Show. Steve Allen had a vibrant comedy spirit, and if you tuned in, you might catch him playing ping pong while suspended from a crane 100 feet in the air, or becoming a human tea bag by dropping himself in a tank of water filled with lemons. In his standard warm-up for the studio audience, when he was asked, "Do they get the show in Omaha?" Steve would answer, "They see it, but they don't get it." I had developed a small reputation for my appearances at the Ice House, And on May 6, 1969, I wrangled a meeting and auditioned in an office for Steve Allen's two producers, Elias Davis and David Pollack. They accepted me with more ease than I expected, and when I spoke with them afterwards, they commented, "There seems to be a dearth of young comedians right now." I looked puzzled. I said, "That's odd. I don't think there are many at all." Their stares made me realize my blunder. I knew the word, but I had the definition backward. For my first appearance on The Steve Allen Show, which was also my first appearance on television as a stand-up, I wore black pants and a bright blue marching band coat that I had picked up in a San Francisco thrift shop. Steve's introduction of me was ad-libbed perfectly. "This next young man is a comedian, and," he stammered, "at first you might not get it," he stammered again, "but then you think about it for a while, and you still don't get it," stammer, stammer, "then you might want to come up on stage and talk to him about it." The Steve Allen appearance went well. He loved the offbeat, and his cackle was enough to make any comedian feel confident. Seated on the sofa, though, I was hammered by another guest, the Dick Van Dyke Show's Maury Amsterdam, for being unconventional. But I bore no grudge. I was so naive I didn't even know I had been insulted. The Steve Allen credit opened a few doors, and I bounced around all of the afternoon shows, juggling material, trying not to repeat myself. I developed a formula of convenience. If I do a bit on Merv Griffin, which comes on at 2 p.m., it's okay to repeat the material on Virginia Graham, which comes on at 4 p.m. If I do a piece on Steve Allen, which comes on at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays, I can do the same bit on Mike Douglas, which comes on at 3 p.m. on Fridays, or something like that. Through the 3 or 4 years I did these shows, I appeared probably 50 times. I recently viewed a musty video of an appearance on the Virginia Graham show, circa 1970, unseen since its airing. I looked grotesque. I had a hairdo like a helmet, which I blow-dried to a puffy bouffant for reasons I no longer understand. I wore a frock coat and a silk shirt, and my delivery was mannered, slow, and self-aware. I had absolutely no authority. After reviewing the show, I was, especially since I was writing an autobiography documenting my success, depressed for a week. But later, searching my mind for at least one redeeming quality in the performance, I became aware that not one joke was normal, that even though I was the one who said the lines, I did not know what was coming next. The audience might have thought what I am thinking now. Was that terrible, or was that good?